drive you up Lansdowne tomorrow. Mind, I'm engaged.
How delightful that will be. My dearest Catherine, I quite envy you. But I am afraid, brother, you will not have room for a third.
A third indeed? No, no, I did not come to Bath to drive my sisters about. That would be a joke, faith. Morland must take care of you.
It would be very kind of you, Mr. Morland.
It will be a pleasure, Miss Thorpe.
I must confess, Miss Morland, I am fond of watching the faces of ladies when about town. There is such fascinating variety. The lady there in blue, she is very handsome. Do not you agree?
Why, yes.
There, the primrose gown. She is a curious kind of ugly, is not she?
I could not say.
A very middling crowd today, I must say. And as for that
Have
lady...
Have you ever read Udolpho, Mr. Thorpe?
Udolpho? Oh, Lord, not I. I never read novels. I have something else to do. Novels are so full of nonsense and stuff. There's not been a tolerably decent one come out since Tom Jones, except The Monk. I read that the other day. But as for all the others, they are the stupidest things in creation.
I think you must like Udolpho if you were to read it. It is so very interesting.
Not I, Faith. No, if I read any, it shall be Mrs. Radcliffe's. Her novels are amusing enough. They are worth reading. Some fun and nature in them.
Udolpho was written by Mrs. Radcliffe.
No, sure. Was it? I remember, so it was. I was thinking of that other stupid book, written by that woman they make such a fuss about, she who married the French emigrant.
I suppose you mean Camilla.
Yes, that's the book. Such unnatural stuff. An old man playing at seesaw. I took up the first volume once and I looked it over, but I soon found out it would not do. Indeed, I guessed what sort of stuff it must be before I saw it. As soon as I heard she married an emigrant, I was sure I should never be able to get through it.
I have never read it.
You had no loss, I assure you. It is the horridest nonsense you can imagine. There is nothing in the world in it but an old man playing at seesaw and learning Latin. Upon my soul, there is not.
Here we are, John. Mother's lodgings. She has descried you already from upstairs. Isabella! John! John, my dear!
Ah, Mother, how do you do? Where did you get that quiz of a hat? It makes you look like an old witch.
This address seemed to satisfy all the fondest wishes of the mother's heart, for she received him with the most delighted and exulting affection. On his two younger sisters he then bestowed an equal portion of his fraternal tenderness, for he asked each of them how they did and observed that they both looked very ugly. These manners did not please Catherine, but he was James's friend and Isabella's brother, and her judgment was further bought off by Isabella's assuring her, when they withdrew to see the new hat, that John thought her the most charming girl in the world, and by John's engaging her before they had parted to dance with him that evening. Had she been older or vainer, such attacks might have done little. But where youth and diffidence are united, it requires uncommon steadiness of reason to resist the attraction of being called the most charming girl in the world, and of being so very early engaged as a partner. Had there been no friendship and no flattery in the case, Catherine would have said she did not like him at all. But when the two Morlands, after sitting an hour with the Thorpes, set off to walk together to Mr. Allen's, she expressed quite the opposite opinion to James.
Well, Catherine, how do you like my friend Thorpe?
I like him very much. He seems very agreeable.
He is as good-natured a fellow as ever lived. A little of a rattle, but that will recommend him to your sex, I believe. And how do you like the rest of the family?
Very, very much indeed. Isabella particularly.
I am very glad to hear you say so. She is just the kind of young woman I could wish to see you attached to. She has so much good sense. She is so thoroughly unaffected and amiable. I always wanted you to know her, and she seems very fond of you. She said the highest things in your praise that could possibly be. And the praise of such a girl as Miss Thorpe, even you, Catherine, may be proud of.
Indeed I am. I love her exceedingly, and I'm delighted to find that you like her too. You hardly mentioned anything of her when you wrote to me after your visit there.
Because I thought I should soon see you myself. I hope you will be a great deal together while you are in Bath. She is a most amiable girl. Such a superior understanding. How fond all the family are of her. She's evidently the general favourite. And how much she must be admired in such a place as this, is not she?
Yes, very much indeed, I fancy. Mr. Allen thinks her the prettiest girl in Bath.
I dare say he does. And I do not know any man who is a better judge of beauty than Mr. Allen. I need not ask you whether you are happy here, my dear Catherine. With such a companion and friend as Isabella Thorpe, it would be impossible for you to be otherwise. And the Allens, I'm sure, are very kind to you.
Yes, very kind. I never was so happy before. And now you are come, it will be more delightful than ever. How good it is of you to come so far on purpose to see me.
Indeed, Catherine, I love you dearly.
Inquiries and communications concerning brothers and sisters, the situation of some, the growth of the rest, and other family matters now passed between them, and continued with only one small digression on James's part in praise of Miss Thorpe, till they reached Pulteney Street, where he was welcomed with great kindness by Mr. and Mrs. Allen, invited by the former to dine with them, and summoned by the latter to guess the price and weigh the merits of a new muff and tippet. A pre-engagement in Edgar's Buildings prevented his accepting the invitation of one friend and obliged him to hurry away as soon as he had satisfied the demands of the other. The time of the two parties uniting in the Octagon Room being correctly adjusted, Catherine was then left to the luxury of a raised, restless and frightened imagination over the pages of Udolpho, lost from all worldly concerns of dressing and dinner, incapable of soothing Mrs. Allen's fears on the delay of an expected dressmaker, and having only 1 minute in 60 to bestow even on the reflection of her own felicity in being already engaged for the evening. In spite of Udolpho and the dressmaker, however, the party from Pulteney Street reached the upper rooms in very good time. The Thorpes and James Morland were there only 2 minutes before them, and Isabella, having gone through the usual ceremonial of meeting her friend with the most smiling and affectionate haste, of admiring the set of her gown and envying the curl of her hair, they followed their chaperones arm in arm into the ballroom, whispering to each other whenever a thought occurred and supplying the place of many ideas by a squeeze of the hand or a smile of affection.
I assure you, I would not stand up without you for all the world. For if I did, we should certainly be separated the whole evening.
The dancing began within a few minutes after they were seated, and James, who had been engaged quite as long as his sister, was very importunate with Isabella to stand up. But John was gone into the card room to speak to a friend, and nothing, she declared, could induce her to join the set before her dear Catherine could join it too. Catherine accepted this kindness with gratitude, and they continued as they were for 3 minutes longer, when Isabella, who had been talking to James on the other side of her, turned again to his sister and whispered,
"My dear creature, I am afraid I must leave you. Your brother is so amazingly impatient to begin. I know you will not mind my going away, and I dare say John will be back in a moment, and then you may easily find me out. Goodbye, my dear love."
Catherine, though a little disappointed, had too much good nature to make any opposition. The younger Miss Thorpes being also dancing, Catherine was left to the mercy of Mrs. Thorpe and Mrs. Allen, between whom she now remained. She could not help being vexed at the non-appearance of Mr. Thorpe, for she not only longed to be dancing, but was likewise aware that as the real dignity of her situation could not be known, she was sharing, with the scores of other young ladies still sitting down, all the discredit of wanting a partner. To be disgraced in the eye of the world, to wear the appearance of infamy, while her heart is all purity, her actions all innocence, and the misconduct of another the true source of her debasement, is one of those circumstances which peculiarly belong to the heroine's life, and her fortitude under it what particularly dignifies her character. Catherine had fortitude too. She suffered, but no murmur passed her lips. From this state of humiliation, she was roused at the end of 10 minutes to a pleasanter feeling by seeing not Mr. Thorpe, but Mr. Tilney, within 3 yards of the place where they sat. He seemed to be moving that way, but he did not see her, and therefore the smile and the blush, which his sudden reappearance raised in Catherine, passed away without sullying her heroic importance. He looked as handsome and as lively as ever, and was talking with interest to a fashionable and pleasing-looking young woman who leant on his arm, and whom Catherine immediately guessed to be his sister, thus unthinkingly throwing away a fair opportunity of considering him lost to her for ever by being married already. But guided only by what was simple and probable, it had never entered her head that Mr. Tilney could be married. He had not behaved, he had not talked like the married men to whom she had been used. He had never mentioned a wife, and he had acknowledged a sister. From these circumstances sprang the instant conclusion of his sister's now being by his side, and therefore, instead of turning of a death-like paleness and falling in a fit on Mrs. Allen's bosom, Catherine sat erect, in the perfect use of her senses, and with cheeks only a little redder than usual. Mr. Tilney and his companion, who continued, though slowly, to approach, were immediately preceded by a lady, an acquaintance of Mrs. Thorpe, and this lady, stopping to speak to her, they, as belonging to her, stopped likewise, and Catherine, catching Mr. Tilney's eye, instantly received from him the smiling tribute of recognition. She returned it with pleasure, and then, advancing still nearer, he spoke both to her and Mrs. Allen, by whom he was very civilly acknowledged.
I'm very happy to see you again, sir, indeed. I was afraid you'd left Bath.
Thank you for your fears, madam. I had quitted Bath for a week on the very morning after having had the pleasure of seeing you.
Well, sir, I dare say you're not sorry to be back again, for it is just the place for young people, and indeed for everybody else too. I tell Mr. Allen when he talks of being sick of it that I'm sure he should not complain, for it is so very agreeable a place that it is much better to be here than at home at this dull time of year. I tell him he is quite in luck to be sent here for his health.
And I hope, madam, that Mr. Allen will be obliged to like the place from finding it of service to him.
Thank you, sir. I have no doubt he will. A neighbour of ours, Dr. Skinner, was here for his health last winter and came away quite stout.
That circumstance must give great encouragement.
Yes, sir. And Dr. Skinner and his family were here 3 months, so I tell Mr. Allen he must not be in a hurry to get away.
Here they were interrupted by a request from Mrs. Thorpe to Mrs. Allen that she would move a little to accommodate Mrs. Hughes and Miss Tilney with seats, as they had agreed to join their party. This was accordingly done, Mr. Tilney still continuing standing before them, and after a few minutes' consideration, he asked Catherine to dance with him. This compliment, delightful as it was, produced severe mortification to the lady, and in giving her denial she expressed her sorrow on the occasion so very much that had Thorpe, who joined her just afterwards, been half a minute earlier, he might have thought her sufferings rather too acute. The very easy manner in which he then told her that he had kept her waiting did not by any means reconcile her more to her lot, nor did the particulars which he entered into while they were standing up of the horses and dogs of the friend whom he had just left, and of a proposed exchange of terriers between them, interest her so much as to prevent her looking very often towards that part of the room where she had left Mr. Tilney. Of her dear Isabella, to whom she particularly longed to point out that gentleman, she could see nothing. She was separated from all her party and away from all her acquaintance. One mortification succeeded another, and from the whole she deduced this useful lesson, that to go previously engaged to a ball does not necessarily increase either the dignity or enjoyment of a young lady. From such a moralising strain as this, she was suddenly roused by a touch on the shoulder, and turning round, perceived Mrs. Hughes directly behind her, attended by Miss Tilney and a gentleman. Mrs. Hughes politely asked to be excused for the liberty, and asked if Miss Morland might like to speak with Miss Tilney a while. Mrs. Hughes could not have applied to any creature in the room more happy to oblige her than Catherine. The young ladies were introduced to each other, Miss Tilney expressing a proper sense of such goodness, Miss Morland with the real delicacy of a generous mind making light of the obligation, and Mrs. Hughes, satisfied with having so respectably settled her young charge, returned to her party. Miss Tilney had a good figure, a pretty face, and a very agreeable countenance, and her air, though it had not all the decided pretension, the resolute stylishness of Miss Thorpe's, had more real elegance. Her manners showed good sense and good breeding. They were neither shy nor affectedly open, and she seemed capable of being young, attractive, and at a ball without wanting to fix the attention of every man near her, and without exaggerated feelings of ecstatic delight or inconceivable vexation on every little trifling occurrence. Catherine, interested at once by her appearance and her relationship to Mr. Tilney, was desirous of being acquainted with her, and readily talked, therefore, whenever she could think of anything to say, and had courage and leisure for saying it. but the hindrance thrown in the way of a very speedy intimacy by the frequent want of one or more of these requisites prevented their doing more than going through the first rudiments of an acquaintance by informing themselves how well the other liked Bath, how much she admired its buildings and surrounding country, whether she drew or played or sang, and whether she was fond of riding on horseback. The dances were scarcely concluded before Catherine found her arm gently seized by her faithful Isabella, who was accompanied by James.
At last I have got you, my dearest creature. I have been looking for you this hour. I have been quite wretched without you.
My dear Isabella, I could not even see where you were.
So I told your brother all the time, but he would not believe me. Do go and see for her, Mr. Morland, said I, but all in vain. He would not stir an inch. Was not it so, Mr. Morland? I have been scolding him to such a degree, my dear Catherine, you would be quite amazed. You know I never stand upon ceremony with such people.
Look at that young lady with the white beads around her head. It is Mr. Tilney's sister.
Oh, heavens, you don't say so. Let me look at her this moment. What a delightful girl. I never saw anything half so beautiful. But where is her all-conquering brother? Is he in the room? Point him out to me this instant if he is. I die to see him. Mr. Morland, you are not to listen. We are not talking about you.
But what is all this whispering about? What is going on?
There now. I knew how it would be. You men have such restless curiosity. Talk of the curiosity of women, indeed. 'Tis nothing. But be satisfied, for you are not to know anything at all of the matter.
Is that likely to satisfy me, do you think?
Well, I declare I never knew anything like you. What can it signify to you what we are talking of? Perhaps we are talking about you. Therefore, I would advise you not to listen, or you may happen to hear something not very agreeable.
In this commonplace chatter, which lasted some time, the original subject seemed entirely forgotten. And though Catherine was very well pleased to have it dropped for a while, she could not avoid a little suspicion at the total suspension of all Isabella's impatient desire to see Mr. Tilney. When the orchestra struck up a fresh dance, James would have led his fair partner away, but she resisted.
I tell you, Mr. Morland, I would do no such thing for all the world. How can you be so teasing? Only conceive, my dear Catherine, what your brother wants me to do. He wants me to dance with him again, though I tell him that it is a most improper thing and entirely against the rules. It would make us the talk of the place if we were not to change partners.
Upon my honour, in these public assemblies, it is as often done as not.
Nonsense! How can you say so? But when you men have a point to carry, you never stick at anything. My sweet Catherine, do support me. Persuade your brother how impossible it is. Tell him that it would quite shock you to see me do such a thing.
No, not at all. But if you think it wrong, you had much better change.
There, you hear what your sister says, and yet you will not mind her. Well, remember that it is not my fault if we set all the old ladies in Bath in a bustle. Come along, my dearest Catherine, for heaven's sake, and stand by me.
And off they went, to regain their former place. John Thorpe, in the meanwhile, had walked away, and Catherine, ever willing to give Mr. Tilney an opportunity of repeating the agreeable request, which had already flattered her once, made her way to Mrs. Allen and Mrs. Thorpe as fast as she could, in the hope of finding him still with them, a hope which, when it proved to be fruitless, she felt to have been highly unreasonable. Mrs. Thorpe was the first to question Catherine.
Well, my dear, I hope you have had an agreeable partner.
Very agreeable, madam.
I'm glad of it. John has charming spirits, has not he?
Did you meet Mr. Tilney, my dear?
No. Where is he?
He was with us just now and said he was so tired of lounging about that he was resolved to go and dance, so I thought perhaps he would ask you if he met with you.
Where can he be?
Ah, there he is. He's got a partner. Wish he'd asked you. He's a very agreeable young man, is he not, Mrs. Thorpe?
Indeed he is, Mrs. Allen. I must say it, though I am his mother, that there is not a more agreeable young man in the world.
I dare say she thought I was speaking of her son.
Catherine was disappointed and vexed. She seemed to have missed by so little the very object she had had in view. And this persuasion did not incline her to a very gracious reply when John Thorpe came up to her soon afterwards.
Well, Miss Morland, I suppose you and I are to stand up and jig it together again?
Oh, no, I am much obliged to you. Our two dances are over, and besides, I am tired and do not mean to dance anymore.
Do not you? Then let us walk about and quiz people. Come along with me, and I will show you the four greatest quizzers in the room. My two younger sisters and their partners. I have been laughing at them this half hour.
Again, Catherine excused herself, and at last he walked off to quiz his sisters by himself. The rest of the evening she found very dull. Mr. Tilney was drawn away from their party at tea to attend that of his partner. Miss Tilney, though belonging to it, did not sit near her, and James and Isabella were so much engaged in conversing together that the latter had no leisure to bestow more on her friend than one smile, one squeeze, and one "Dearest Catherine." The progress of Catherine's unhappiness from the events of the evening was as follows. It appeared first in a general dissatisfaction with everybody about her while she remained in the rooms, which speedily brought on considerable weariness and a violent desire to go home. This, on arriving in Pulteney Street, took the direction of extraordinary hunger, and when that was appeased, changed into an earnest longing to be in bed. Such was the extreme point of her distress, for when there she immediately fell into a sound sleep which lasted 9 hours and from which she awoke perfectly revived, in excellent spirits, with fresh hopes and fresh schemes. The first wish of her heart was to improve her acquaintance with Miss Tilney, and almost her first resolution to seek her for that purpose in the pump room at noon. In the pump room, one so newly arrived in Bath must be met with, and that building she had already found so favourable for the discovery of female excellence and the completion of female intimacy, so admirably adapted for secret discourses and unlimited confidence, that she was most reasonably encouraged to expect another friend from within its walls. Her plan for the morning thus settled, she sat quietly down to her book after breakfast, resolving to remain in the same place and the same employment till the clock struck one. Thus occupied, Catherine was very little incommoded by the remarks and ejaculations of Mrs. Allen, whose vacancy of mind and incapacity for thinking was such that as she never talked a great deal, so she could never be entirely silent. And therefore, while she sat at her work, if she lost her needle or broke her thread, if she heard a carriage in the street or saw a speck upon her gown, she must observe it aloud, whether there were anyone at leisure to answer her or not. At about 12:30, a remarkably loud rap drew her in haste to the window.
Oh, there are two open carriages at the door, my dear. There isn't the first, only a servant, and your brother is driving Miss Thorpe in the second. Ah! And here is Mr. Thorpe.
How do you do, Mrs. Allen? A famous ball last night, was not it? Well, Miss Morland, here I am. Have you been waiting long? We could not come before. The old devil of a coachmaker was such an eternity finding out a thing fit to be got into for Morland and my sister. And now it is 10,000 to 1, but they break down before we are out of the street. Come, Miss Morland, be quick, for the others are in a confounded hurry to be off. They want to get their tumble over.
What do you mean? Where are you all going to?
Why, you have not forgot our engagement. Did not we agree together to take a drive this morning? What a head you have. We are going up Claverton Down.
Something was said about it, I remember. But really, I did not expect you.
Not expect me? That's a good one. And what a dust you would have made if I had not come.
Well, ma'am, what do you say to it? Can you spare me for an hour or two? Shall I go?
Do just as you please, my dear.
I shall get ready. Please, excuse me for a moment.
What do you think of my gig, Mrs. Allen? It is very fine, is not it?
Very fine indeed, Mr. Thorpe.
I bought it from a friend of mine. He had it but a few weeks. Curricle hung, of course. Seat, trunk, splashing board, sword case, lamps, silver moulding, all you see complete. I have not seen any gig in Bath so fine.
I dare say you're right. You shall have the most delightful drive. Is it your own horse?
I should ride nothing else. He cannot go less than 10 miles an hour. I told Miss Morland so yesterday. She is a most agreeable young lady.
We are most fond of her. How glad I am that she accompanied us to Bath. It is just the place for young people. Aha, here is Catherine.
I'm ready.
Well, my dear, I wish you the most pleasant drive.
Thank you, ma'am.
Goodbye, Mrs. Allen.
Goodbye, Mr. Thorpe.
My dearest creature.
Good afternoon, Isabella. James, I see you found a coracle of your own.
Dearest Catherine, you have been at least 3 hours getting ready. I was afraid you were ill. What a delightful ball we had last night. I have 1,000 things to say to you, but make haste and get into the gig with my brother, for I long to be off.
You will not be frightened, Miss Morland, if my horse should dance about a little at first setting off. He will most likely give a plunge or two, but he will soon know his master. He is full of spirits, playful as can be, but there is no advice in him.
Catherine did not think the portrait a very inviting one, but it was too late to retreat, and she was too young to own herself frightened, and off they went in the quietest manner imaginable, without a plunge or a caper or anything like one. Catherine, delighted at so happy an escape, spoke her pleasure aloud with grateful surprise, and her companion immediately made the matter perfectly simple by assuring her that it was entirely owing to the peculiarly judicious manner in which he had then held the reins and the singular discernment and dexterity with which he had directed his whip. Catherine, though she could not help wondering that with such perfect command of his horse he should think it necessary to alarm her with a relation of its tricks, congratulated herself sincerely on being under the care of so excellent a coachman. The animal continued to go on in the same quiet manner, without showing the smallest propensity towards any unpleasant vivacity, and, considering its inevitable pace was 10 miles an hour, by no means alarmingly fast, and therefore Catherine gave herself up to all the enjoyment of air and exercise of the most invigorating kind, in a fine, mild day of February, with the consciousness of safety. A silence of several minutes succeeded their first short dialogue. It was broken by Thorpe's saying very abruptly,
"Old Allen is as rich as Croesus, is not he?"
"I do not understand."
"Old Allen, the man you are with."
"Oh, Mr. Allen, you mean. Yes, I believe he is very rich."
"And no children at all?"
"No, not any."
"A famous thing for his next heirs. He is your godfather, is not he?"
"My godfather? No."
"But you are always very much with them."
"Yes, very much."
That is what I meant. He seems a good kind of old fellow enough, and he lived very well in his time, I dare say. He's not gouty for nothing. Does he drink his bottle a day now?"
"His bottle a day? No. Why should you think of such a thing? He is a very temperate man, and you could not fancy him in liquor last night."
"Lord help you. You women are always thinking of men's being in liquor. Why, you do not suppose a man overset by a bottle? I am sure of this, that if everybody was to drink their bottle of day, there would not be half the disorders in the world there are now. It would be a famous good thing for us all."
"I cannot believe it."
"Oh, Lord, it would be the saving of thousands. There is not the 1/100th part of the wine consumed in this kingdom that there ought to be. Our foggy climate wants help."
"And yet I have heard that there is a great deal of wine drank in Oxford."
"Oxford? There is no drinking at Oxford now, I assure you. Nobody drinks there. You would hardly meet with a man who goes beyond his 4 pints at the utmost. Now, for instance, it was reckoned a remarkable thing at the last party in my rooms that upon an average we cleared about 5 pints a head. It was looked upon as something out of the common way. Mine is famous good stuff, to be sure. You would not often meet with anything like it in Oxford, and that may account for it, but this will just give you a notion of the general rate of drinking there."
"Yes, it does give a notion, and that is that you all drink a great deal more wine than I thought you did. However, I am sure James does not drink so much."
Thorpe's ideas then all reverted to the merits of his own equipage, and she was called on to admire the spirit and freedom with which his horse moved along, and the ease which his paces, as well as the excellence of the springs, gave the motion of the carriage. She followed him in all his admiration as well as she could. To go before or beyond him was impossible. His knowledge and her ignorance of the subject, his rapidity of expression and her diffidence of herself, put that out of her power. She could strike out nothing new in commendation, but she readily echoed whatever he chose to assert, and it was finally settled between them without any difficulty that his equipage was altogether the most complete of its kind in England, his carriage the neatest, his horse the best goer, and himself the best coachman. Catherine, venturing after some time to consider the matter as entirely decided, offered some little variation on the subject.
You do not really think, Mr. Thorpe, that James's gig will break down?
Break down? Oh, Lord, did you ever see such a little tit-uppy thing in your life? There is not a sound piece of iron about it. The wheels have been fairly worn out these 10 years, at least. And as for the body, upon my soul, you might shake it to pieces yourself with a touch. It is the most devilish little rickety business I ever beheld. Thank God we have a better. I would not be bound to go 2 miles in it for £50,000.
Good heavens! Well, then, pray, let us turn back. Or they will certainly meet with an accident if we go on. Do let us turn back, Mr. Thorpe. Stop and speak to my brother and tell him how very unsafe it is.
Unsafe? Oh, Lord, what is there in that? They will only get a roll if it does break down, and there is plenty of dirt. It will be excellent falling. Oh, curse it. The carriage is safe enough if a man knows how to drive it. A thing of that sort in good hands will last about 20 years after it is fairly worn out. Lord bless you. I would undertake for £5 to drive it to York and back again without losing a nail.
Catherine listened with astonishment. She knew not how to reconcile two such very different accounts of the same thing, for she had not been brought up to understand the propensities of a rattle, nor to know to how many idle assertions and impudent falsehoods the excess of vanity will lead. Her own family were plain, matter-of-fact people who seldom aimed at wit of any kind, her father, at the utmost, being contented with a pun, and her mother with a proverb. They were not in the habit, therefore, of telling lies to increase their importance, or of asserting at one moment what they would contradict the next. She reflected on the affair for some time in much perplexity, and was more than once on the point of requesting from Mr. Thorpe a clearer insight into his real opinion on the subject. But she checked herself, because it appeared to her that he did not excel in giving those clearer insights, in making those things plain which he had before made ambiguous. Joining to this the consideration that he would not really suffer his sister and his friend to be exposed to a danger from which he might easily preserve them, she concluded at last that he must know the carriage to be in fact perfectly safe, and therefore would alarm herself no longer. By him, the whole matter seemed entirely forgotten, and all the rest of his conversation, or rather talk, began and ended with himself and his own concerns. He told her of horses, which he had bought for a trifle and sold for incredible sums, of racing matches in which his judgment had infallibly foretold the winner, of shooting parties in which he had killed more birds, though without having one good shot, than all his companions together, and described to her some famous day's sport with the foxhounds in which his foresight and skill in directing the dogs had repaired the mistakes of the most experienced huntsman, and in which the boldness of his riding, though it had never endangered his own life for a moment, had been constantly leading others into difficulties which he calmly concluded had broken the necks of many. Little as Catherine was in the habit of judging for herself, and unfixed as were her general notions of what men ought to be, she could not entirely repress a doubt, while she bore with the effusions of his endless conceit, of his being altogether completely agreeable. It was a bold surmise, for he was Isabella's brother, and she had been assured by James that his manners would recommend him to all her sex. But in spite of this, the extreme weariness of his company, which crept over her before they had been out an hour, and which continued unceasingly to increase till they stopped in Pulteney Street again, induced her in some small degree to resist such high authority, and to distrust his powers of giving universal pleasure. When they arrived at Mrs. Allen's door, the astonishment of Isabella was hardly to be expressed on finding that it was too late in the day for them to attend her friend into the house. Past 3 o'clock! It was inconceivable, incredible, impossible. And she would neither believe her own watch, nor her brother's, nor the servant's. She would believe no assurance of it founded on reason or reality till Morland produced his watch and ascertained the fact. To have doubted a moment longer then would have been equally inconceivable, incredible, and impossible, and she could only protest over and over again that no 2 hours and a half had ever gone off so swiftly before. Her own feelings entirely engrossed her. Her wretchedness was most acute on finding herself obliged to go directly home. It was ages since she had had a moment's conversation with her dearest Catherine, and though she had such thousands of things to say to her, it appeared as if they were never to be together again. So, with smiles of most exquisite misery and the laughing eye of utter despondency, she bade her friend adieu and went on. Catherine went in and found Mrs. Allen just returned from all the busy idleness of the morning.
Well, my dear, here you are. I hope you had a pleasant airing.
Yes, ma'am. I thank you. We could not have had a nicer day.
So Mrs. Thorpe said. She was vastly pleased at you all going.
You have seen Mrs. Thorpe, then?
Yes, I went to the pump room as soon as you were gone, and there I met her, and we had a great deal of talk together. She says there was hardly any veal to be got at market this morning. It is so uncommonly scarce.
Did you see anybody else of our acquaintance?
Yes, we agreed to take a turn in the Crescent, and there we met Mrs. Hughes and Mr. and Miss Tilney walking with her.
Did you indeed? And did they speak to you?
Yes, we walked along the Crescent together for half an hour. They seem very agreeable people. Miss Tilney was in a very pretty spotted muslin, and I fancy, by what I can learn, that she always dresses very handsomely. Mrs. Hughes talked to me a great deal about the family.
And what does she tell you of them?
Oh, vast deal indeed. She hardly talked of anything else.
Did she tell you what part of Gloucestershire they come from?
Yes, she did, but I cannot recollect now, but they are very good kind of people and very rich. Mrs. Tilney was a Miss Drummond, and she and Mrs. Hughes were school fellows, and Miss Drummond had a very large fortune, and when she married, her father gave her £20,000 and £500 to buy wedding clothes. Mrs. Hughes saw all the clothes after they came from the warehouse.
And are Mr. and Mrs. Tilney in Bath?
Yes, I fancy they are, but I'm not quite certain. Upon recollection, however, I have a notion that they're both dead. At least the mother is. Yes, I'm sure Mrs. Tilney is dead, because Mrs. Hughes told me that there was a very beautiful set of pearls that Mr. Drummond gave his daughter on their wedding day, and that Miss Tilney has got them now, for they were put by for her when her mother died.
And is Mr. Tilney the only son?
I cannot be quite positive about that, my dear. I have some idea he is, but however, he is a very fine young man, Mrs. Hughes says, and is likely to do very well.
Catherine inquired no further. She had heard enough to feel that Mrs. Allen had no real intelligence to give, and that she was most particularly unfortunate herself in having missed such a meeting with both brother and sister. Could she have foreseen such a circumstance, nothing could have persuaded her to go out with the others, and as it was, she could only lament her ill luck and think over what she had lost till it was clear to her that the drive had by no means been very pleasant and that John Thorpe himself was quite disagreeable. Catherine's resolution of endeavouring to meet Miss Tilney again continued in full force the next morning, and she attended the pump room with Mrs. Allen in eager expectation.
Shall we take one more turn about the room?
I think we have seen every new face and bonnet three times over.
Nonsense, we've only been here a quarter of an hour. Ah, there is your Miss Tilney now.
Will you excuse me, Mrs. Allen?
Go on, my dear.
Catherine moved hastily through the crowds towards Miss Tilney. She was all eager anticipation in spite of her nerves.
Miss Tilney!
Good day, Miss Morland.
Oh, may I speak with you a while?
Of course, I should be delighted.
There was so little time for us to speak at the ball.
And the crowds can be most tiresome.
I thought your gown more elegant than any other. I think the same again today.
You are very kind.
I say it sincerely.
Thank you.
I have learned a great deal about dresses from Mrs. Allen.
I'm sure you have. She seems an expert in fashion.
How well your brother dances.
Henry? Yes, he does dance very well.
He must have thought it very odd to hear me say I was engaged the other evening, when he saw me sitting down. But I really had been engaged the whole day to Mr. Thorpe. You cannot think how surprised I was to see Mr. Tilney again. I felt so sure of his being quite gone away.
When Henry had the pleasure of seeing you before, he was in Bath but for a couple of days. He only came to engage lodgings for us.
That never occurred to me. And, of course, not seeing him anywhere, I thought he must be gone. Was not the young lady he danced with on Monday a Miss Smith?
Yes, an acquaintance of Mrs. Hughes.
I dare say she was very glad to dance. Do you think her pretty?
Not very.
He never comes to the pump room, I suppose.
Yes, sometimes, but he has rid out this morning with my father. I'm afraid I must go. Mrs. Hughes and I have another appointment.
I hope I shall have the pleasure of seeing you again soon. Shall you be at the Cotillion Ball tomorrow?
Perhaps we... Yes, I think we certainly shall.
I am glad of it, for we shall all be there.
It shall be delightful for us all to be together.
They parted, on Miss Tilney's side with some knowledge of her new acquaintance's feelings, and on Catherine's without the smallest consciousness of having explained them. She went home very happy. The morning had answered all her hopes, and the evening of the following day was now the object of expectation, the future good. What gown and what headdress she should wear on the occasion became her chief concern. She lay awake 10 minutes debating between her spotted and her tambourine muslin, entirely unaware of the insensibility of man towards a new gown. It would be mortifying to the feelings of many ladies if they knew how little the heart of man is affected by what is costly or new in their attire. Woman is fine for her own satisfaction alone. But these grave reflections did not trouble the tranquillity of Catherine. She entered the rooms the following evening, chiefly anxious to avoid Thorpe's sight, lest he should engage her again. For though she could not, dared not expect that Mr. Tilney should ask her a third time to dance, her wishes, hopes and plans all centred in nothing less. Every young lady may feel for my heroine in this critical moment, for every young lady has been, or at least all have believed themselves to be, in danger from the pursuit of someone whom they wished to avoid, and all have been anxious for the attentions of someone whom they wished to please.
Oh, what crowds! I cannot see the Tilneys anywhere, Catherine.
Nor I.
Oh, never mind, for there is Miss Thorpe and Mr. Thorpe come to join you. I shall take my leave of you young people.
Oh, Mrs. Allen, please wait.
Do not fret, my dear. Mrs. Hughes and Mrs. Thorpe shall be nearby, I'm sure.
Catherine, my dear creature.
Isabella, how handsome you look.
The men have such an eye for new gowns, do not you find? But let us not talk of it now, for you see that my brother is coming to join us.
Yes.
I have never seen you so attached to your fan. You look quite shy. You are too modest when you look so pretty.
What is this? Are you conspiring already? You ladies are famous good at it.
Conspiring? We should not tell you if we are. Where is Mr. Morland? Was he with you?
He's taking a rest after your last cotillion. You ladies should dance the whole night without a breath if you could. Is that not true, Miss Morland? I dare say you and I shall dance later.
Dear John, it seems you have been snubbed. Catherine is in a queer mood this evening.
No matter. I must search out a glass of wine. Ladies, do excuse me.
Do not be frightened, my dear Catherine, but I'm really going to dance with your brother again. I declare positively it is quite shocking. I tell him he ought to be ashamed of himself, but you and John must keep us in countenance. I must join Mr. Morland. Make haste, my dear creature, and come to us. John will be back in a moment.
Good evening, Miss Morland. My sister told me you would be here.
Mr. Tilney, you gave me quite a start.
I see the country dances have just begun.
Yes, indeed.
Would you care to join the next dance?
I would be delighted.
Let me see if there is a less crowded set. I shall only be a moment.
Hey, day, Miss Morland, what is the meaning of this? I thought you and I were to dance together.
I wonder you should think so, for you never asked me.
That is a good one. By Jove, I asked you as soon as I came into the room, and I was just about to ask you again. This is a cursed shabby trick. I only came for the sake of dancing with you, and I firmly believe you were engaged to me ever since Monday. Yes, I remember. I asked you while we were waiting in the lobby for your cloak. And here I've been telling all my acquaintances that I was going to dance with the prettiest girl in the room, and when they see you standing up with somebody else, they will quiz me famously.
Oh, no. Oh, they will never think of me after such a description as that.
By heavens, if they do not, I will kick them out of the room for blockheads. What chap asked you to dance?
Mr. Tilney.
Tilney? I do not know him. A good figure of a man, well put together. Does he want a horse? A friend of mine, Sam Fletcher, has got one to sell that would suit anybody. A famous, clever animal for the road. Only 40 guineas. I had 50 minds to buy it myself, but it would not answer my purpose. It would not do for the field. I would give any money for a real good hunter. I have 3 now, the best that ever were backed. I would not take 800 guineas for them. I shall find Fletcher now. I cannot think Tilney would turn down his horse for the world. 40 guineas, a bargain, a prodigious bargain. Oh, I will leave you as I see your partner returns.
Oh, his tail goes so
Miss Morland, did that gentleman engage you before I?
No, Mr. Tilney. Oh, please excuse me, I'm at liberty again.
He would have put me out of patience had he stayed with you half a minute longer. He has no business to withdraw the attention of my partner from me. We have entered into a contract of mutual agreeableness for the space of an evening, and all our agreeableness belongs solely to each other for that time. Nobody can fasten themselves on the notice of one without injuring the rights of the other. I consider a country dance as an emblem of marriage. Fidelity and complaisance are the principal duties of both, and those men who do not choose to dance or marry themselves have no business with the partners or wives of their neighbours.
But they are such very different things.
That you think they cannot be compared together?
To be sure not. People that marry can never part, but must go and keep house together. People that dance only stand opposite each other in a long room for half an hour.
And such is your definition of matrimony and dancing. Taken in that light, certainly their resemblance is not striking, but I think I could place them in such a view. You will allow that in both, man has the advantage of choice, woman only the power of refusal. That in both, it is an engagement between man and woman formed for the advantage of each, and that when once entered into, they belong exclusively to each other till the moment of its dissolution. That it is their duty, each to endeavour to give the other no cause for wishing that he or she had bestowed themselves elsewhere, and their best interest to keep their own imaginations from wandering towards the perfections of their neighbours, or fancying that they should have been better off with anyone else. You will allow all this?
Yes, to be sure, as you stated. All this sounds very well. But still, they are so very different. I cannot look upon them at all in the same light, nor think the same duties belong to them.
In one respect, there certainly is a difference. In marriage, the man is supposed to provide for the support of the woman, the woman to make the home agreeable to the man. He is to purvey and she is to smile. But in dancing, their duties are exactly changed. The agreeableness, the compliance are expected from him, while she furnishes the fan and the lavender water. That, I suppose, was the difference of duties which struck you as rendering the conditions incapable of comparison.
No, indeed. I never thought of that.
Then I am quite at a loss. One thing, however, I must observe. This disposition on your side is rather alarming. You totally disallow any similarity in the obligations, and may I not thence infer that your notions of the duties of the dancing state are not so strict as your partner might wish? Have I not reason to fear that if the gentleman who spoke to you just now were to return, or if any other gentleman were to address you, there would be nothing to restrain you from conversing with him as long as you chose?
Mr. Thorpe is such a very particular friend of my brother's that if he talks to me, I must talk to him again. But there are hardly three young men in the room besides him that I have any acquaintance with.
And that is to be my only security. Alas, alas.
Nay, I am sure you cannot have a better, for if I do not know anybody, it is impossible for me to talk to them. And, besides, I do not want to talk to anybody.
Now you have given me a security worth having, and I shall proceed with courage. Do you find Bath as agreeable as when I had the honour of making the inquiry before?
Yes, quite. More so, indeed.
More so? Take care, or you will forget to be tired of it at the proper time. You ought to be tired at the end of 6 weeks.
I do not think I should be tired if I were to stay here 6 months.
Bath, compared with London, has little variety, and so everybody finds out every year. For 6 weeks, I allow Bath is pleasant enough. But beyond that, it is the most tiresome place in the world. You would be told so by people of all descriptions who come regularly every winter, lengthen their 6 weeks into 10 or 12, and go away at last because they can afford to stay no longer.
Well, other people must judge for themselves. And those who go to London may think nothing of Bath, but I, who live in a small, retired village in the country, can never find greater sameness in such a place as this than in my own home. For here are a variety of amusements, a variety of things to be seen and done all day long, which I can know nothing of there.
You are not fond of the country?
Yes, I am. I have always lived there, and always been very happy. But certainly there is much more sameness in a country life than in a Bath life. One day in the country is exactly like another.
But then you spend your time so much more rationally in the country.
Do I?
Do you not?
I do not believe there is much difference.
Here you are in pursuit only of amusement all day long.
And so I am at home, only I do not find so much of it. I walk about here, and so I do there, but here I see a variety of people in every street, and there I can only go and call on Mrs. Allen.
Only go and call on Mrs. Allen? What a picture of intellectual poverty. However, when you sink into this abyss again, you will have more to say. You will be able to talk of Bath and all that you did here.
Oh, yes. I shall never be in want of something to talk of again to Mrs. Allen or anybody else. I really believe I shall always be talking of Bath when I'm at home again. I do like it so very much. If I could but have Papa and Mama and the rest of them here, I suppose I should be too happy. James is coming, my eldest brother, is quite delightful. And especially as it turns out that the very family we are just got so intimate with are his intimate friends already. Who can ever be tired of Bath?
Not those who bring such fresh feelings of every sort to it as you do. But papas and mamas and brothers and intimate friends are a good deal gone by to most of the frequenters of Bath, and the honest relish of balls and plays and everyday sights is passed with them. Come, we have talked too long. Let us dance.
Henry and Catherine took their places at the top of the set.
You have a very light step, Miss Morgan.
Thank you. You dance very well. I told your sister so just yesterday.
Yes, she told me. Oh, do not fear, I'm not so vain as to remember the compliment.
But you just did remember it.
Remember what?
Soon after their reaching the bottom of the set, Catherine perceived herself to be earnestly regarded by a gentleman who stood among the lookers-on, immediately behind her partner. He was a very handsome man, of a commanding aspect, past the bloom, but not past the vigour of life. And with his eyes still directed towards her, she saw him presently address Mr. Tilney in a familiar whisper. Confused by his notice, and blushing from the fear of its being excited by something wrong in her appearance, she turned away her head.
Henry, who is that you're dancing with?
It's Miss Morland, Father.
Do you think highly of her?
I do. She is from a most respectable family, and the Allens are her chaperones. You may make your inquiries.
The gentleman retreated, and Catherine's partner, coming nearer, said,
I see that you guessed what I've just been asked. That gentleman knows your name, and you have a right to know his. It is General Tilney, my father.
Oh.
There is my sister. Let us leave this set and join her. Eleanor?
Henry, Miss Morland, have you had an agreeable dance?
Most agreeable. Miss Morland is very accomplished.